This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This August, the Olympic Games returned to Greece for the first time since 1896. Athens was the site for those first games of the modern era, and their return has been plagued by construction delays, security concerns, and now a doping scandal that may keep some of the best athletes out of this summer's competition. We'll get to that later this hour. But first, we're taking advantage of a new book on the ancient Olympics to talk about what we've retained from the original festival of the ancient Greeks and the many changes. They had their scandals too, mostly bribery. Those games were also sensationally popular and had a lot of problems accommodating all the spectators. In his book, The Naked Olympics, Tony Perrottet describes Olympia's modest facilities as reminiscent of a badly planned rock concert. There were no team sports in the old days, no ball sports, no swimming events, no marathon, and surprise, surprise, nothing resembling an Olympic torch. And perhaps the biggest surprise of them all, for those of you contemplating the prices to see the opening ceremony in Athens, admission to Olympia was free. This hour, we're going to rewind a couple of thousand years. If you have questions about what it was like to attend or participate in the ancient Olympics, or what traces of the past can be found in Greece today, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Tony Perrottet is the author of The Naked Olympics, The True Story of the Ancient Games. He joins us now from our bureau in New York. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Oh, hey, Neil.
So, no torch.
No torch. It was actually concocted for the Nazi Olympics in 1936. Hitler had a great interest in the ancient games, and he had his sidekick, Dr. Karl Diem, who was an archaeologist, dig up a few pseudo-classical events to give it a little more prestige. There used to be in some of the smaller festivals in ancient Greece, torch races, and so he took that. It never actually occurred in the Olympics. And came up with it to go from Olympia to Berlin to light the torch there. It became part and parcel of the games today.
Well, everybody knows about the ancient Olympics. Some more know about the Pythian Games. But I didn't realize to the extent that these were all part of a professional sports circuit in the ancient world.
Oh, yeah, there used to be 350 or so athletic games around the Aegean, and the ancient Greeks thought having money was quite a good thing. There was no real concept of amateurism at all. The closest thing that the Greeks had to amateur was the word idiotes, which means an unskilled person. So it was perfectly acceptable to make good money out of being an athlete. The Olympics were actually kind of unique in not having cash prizes. Every other version of the games would have some sort of reward. They just had the olive wreath. But having said that, if you won the Olympic Games, you were a made man. You were set for life. You never had to work again, basically. The home cities for the athletes would give enormous prizes to anyone who brought back the wreath. You'd come back in a grand procession. You'd get olive oil supplies for life. You'd have front row seats in the theatre, pension plans, and in fact meals for as long as you lived. So money actually permeated ancient athletics.
Now, some of the characters also reminiscent more perhaps of the World Wrestling Foundation than our ideals of ancient athletes. Tell us a little bit about Milo of Croton.
He was the he came from southern Italy. He was the original Italian stallion. He was unique, and he won five Olympiads in a row as a wrestler. And it was incredibly popular, apparently a very, very nice guy. He used to turn up at the Olympic Games, and one of his tricks was to put a full-grown, a calf on his shoulders, a calf bull, and carry it around and then have it cooked up and eat the whole thing as dinner for dinner.
And he would bet people, hold up his pinky, and he says, I'll bet no man here can bend my pinky.
And apparently it was true. He was he actually kept going until the age of 40, and on his sixth attempt at the Olympiad, he was defeated. He was still incredibly popular. However, I don't think he wasn't terribly smart. He went back to southern Italy, and then he died in this kind of tragic way. He found a tree that was split open by a log, and he put his hand in and took out the log, and he got trapped in the tree and was devoured by wolves.
Oh, ouch. What a way to go.
Yeah.
But even the great athletes, there were statues of them all over. If you won a certain number of times, you were entitled to erect your likeness. You spent a lot of time in this book trying to describe, give us an idea of what it was like to either participate as an athlete, a modern-day Milo, or to attend the Olympic Games back, say, 150 B.C. or so as a spectator. So take us back. What was it like to go to Olympia and attend the Olympic Games?
Well, as an athlete, I think it was the pinnacle of your career. You would have started special training 10 months beforehand, and then 30 days beforehand you had to turn up and sign on at this city of Ellis, which was the organisers of the Games. And you went through a very gruelling regime for 30 days, very punishing. It made anyone who wasn't up to Olympic standards drop out. And then you went on a grand procession 2 days before the Games. It was a 40-mile hike in the middle of the Mediterranean heat to arrive at the site. And but those who did make it, it was apparently an extraordinary vision, because you'd see 70,000 people gathered around this small sanctuary in the middle of the Peloponnesian countryside. Which brings me to the spectators. They're actually rather a fit and healthy bunch, the spectators, because they often had to hike themselves 210 miles, say, from Athens to the site of Olympia. And once they arrived, rather dirty and footsore, they found something of a disaster of a site, because there were no facilities whatsoever.
Well, go back to that journey. This must have taken a couple of weeks.
Oh, it did take a couple of weeks, and mostly on foot, because the roads in the classical era were kind of terrible. People could sail from the other parts of the Mediterranean, but within Greece they would mostly hike, and the wealthy would have a mule, throw their luggage on the mule, but most sports fans just threw something over their shoulder, some bedding and a change of clothes, and turned up.
Your description of roadside inns that make you really make you hanker after maybe a red roof.
Yeah, the Greek inns were actually famous for being squalid and desperate places. They were. If you dreamed of an innkeeper, it meant you would probably die. They were considered notorious for bad food and bad. Everyone was sort of crowded in together and filled with mosquitoes and leaky roofs. And I've stayed in a few places in Greece like that myself. But when once they arrived, the hardships were hardly over, because it was an incredibly uncomfortable place. I compare it to a badly planned rock concert, because sort of the Woodstock of antiquity, because 70,000 people just coming to a place that it's really, for 47 months out of 48, it's just a serene little collection of temples and altars, basically in a very verdant but remote place. And then suddenly everyone's turning up. There's one hotel, and that's reserved for VIPs and ambassadors. Everyone else just has to camp out in the open air, and the wealthy put up tents, and some of the tents were apparently very beautiful, with tiles and artworks and the whole bit. But everyone else is just throwing their bedding out in the middle of nowhere. There's terrible water shortages, because this is the height of the Mediterranean summer. So the two rivers in Olympia have actually dried up. So water has to be brought in from elsewhere. The garbage is just left piled around all over the place. A lot of sacrificial meat rotting in the sun. There's terrible sanitation problems, because there's nowhere to go to the bathroom. So the dry rivers become open air latrines. And the stench apparently was quite astonishing. 70,000 people relieving themselves. And, there was a terrible bug problem as well in Olympia. The insects were so bad that the priests would actually sacrifice to an altar to Zeus, the averter of flies, to try and keep the plagues at bay.
Yet for 1,200 years, this was the biggest event of its time. Why did people go?
Well, it was an amazing spectacle. It was just an extraordinary event. It was as close as you could come to feeling the aura of the gods in one spot. And in fact, the philosopher Epictetus discussed this. He thought the Olympics were like a metaphor for life. He said they were noisy, they were hot, they were crowded, they were uncomfortable, but they're worth it, because it's just an amazing thing to see. People would go back, if they could, they would go back again and again. And we have records of one baker on his tombstone said that he went 12 times. The Games.
Our number, if you'd like to join our conversation with Tony Perrottet, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. Let's talk to Steve, who joins us from Sacramento.
Hi, Neil. How you doing?
Very well.
My question is, I know that boxing was part of some ancient games. Was it part of the Olympics? And if so, were there weight classes?
It was absolutely part of the Olympics. It was one of the favourite events. All the body contact sports were very popular. There were no weight classes, which meant that the heavyweights tended to dominate. It was quite a spectacular event because they would wrap leather thongs around their knuckles, sort of like knuckle dusters today, and they would pummel each other's heads. There were no body blows allowed. There was no ring. They would sort of go around the stadium, you know, chasing one another, and no rounds. So they just like kept punching one another in the head. Until one gave up. It was apparently extremely dangerous. There's one famous story of a guy had his... many of them had their teeth knocked out, but one guy, gained great honour because he didn't want to give his opponent the satisfaction of seeing him spit out his teeth, so he swallowed them all.
Ooh.
Yeah, quite a thing.
Yeah. Steve, thank you. As dangerous as boxing sounds, though, it is nothing compared to your description of what the chariot races were like.
Yeah, they were an amazing spectacle, and they were very dangerous as well. Often there were accidents left, right and centre, and all these spectators were actually gathered on the side of the hippodrome on grassy banks. So if there was a real spill, they'd go into the audience and kill a few of those as well. There's one case where 22 chariots were going around and only one made it around the whole course.
22 four-horse chariots racing around.
Yeah, quite a scene. And in fact, the famous chariot race in Ben-Hur in the Charlton Heston version, although the hippodrome was a much more rural setting, it actually captures that sort of sense of danger and excitement and spectacle that really got people going. And it was the chariot race that actually opened the games. It was the most spectacular, probably, of the sports there. And the Greeks were great gamblers, so they loved to gather early in the morning and they would go around sniffing the manure of the horses to see what fodder they'd had, and then they would all go off and bet these amazing things. And one of the great problems was that people were always laying curses on opposing charioteers. So they would write them on these lead tablets, which would be buried in cemeteries, in the hopes that the dead would take them to the underworld and lay curses upon the charioteers, making them fall out of their chariots or be killed. So it was quite a stressful occupation, I think.
And for all of that, the charioteer would emerge triumphant and the olive wreath would be taken, and not by him, but by the owner.
Yeah, it was the owner that won, and the charioteer was merely carrying out the... I mean, he was highly regarded, but it was nothing compared to being the owner. It was the owner who put on the victory party and gained all the prestige.
Let's get another caller in. This is Alex, who's with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hello, I have a question about Diagoras of Rhodes. I heard a legend from my grandfather that Diagoras was a boxer and had two children that, when he was an old man, had both won Olympic titles themselves. Could you fill me in on anything about Diagoras of Rhodes?
Yeah, he was a victor himself, and his two children, when his two sons won, Diagoras was carried out of the stadium to great esteem, and someone yelled out, "You might as well drop dead now, because things can get no better," basically. And
the highlight of your life, right?
Yes,
it's all downhill
it,
from here.
Yes, because it was because the prestige of the games was often, in a sense, passed on. So if you were a champion and your sons became champions, it was just a wonderful thing.
Your family has a connection with Rhodes or Diagoras, Alex?
No, there's no connection. I just heard a legend that he actually did drop dead at that very moment.
Yeah, I heard that, but who knows whether that's really true. It's almost too good a story like that. But yeah, that's what the sources do say.
Well, let's not find anything out. It's too good a story to investigate. Alex, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
We're talking about the original Olympic Games in Athens, and the original Olympic Games in Olympia a couple of thousand years ago. And when we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Also, you email TOTN@npr.org. Our guest is Tony Perrottet. His new book is The Naked Olympics, The True Story of the Ancient Games. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Tony Perrottet, the author of The Naked Olympics, The True Story of the Ancient Games. If you have a question for our guest about what those original games were like, call us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's talk with Jeff, who joins us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just thinking, like, we have a lot of scandals in, like, today's Olympics, so I was wondering if there are any major scandals in the ancient Olympics or something like that.
Oh, absolutely. It was regarded as a fairly clean sort of games compared to some of the others. But in the 4th century BC, a chap named Eubulus of Thessaly was a boxer, and he was caught bribing his opponents to throw their game against him. The judges fined him a huge amount, and they used the money to create a statue of Zeus. And what happened is he was the first one that was caught, let's say. So corruption charges did crop up again and again in the Olympics, and every time they were caught, they would find them more money. So what happened was there was a series of statues of Zeus that the athletes would pass on the way into the stadium, and they had little signs saying, at the Olympics you should win with the speed of your feet and the strength of your body, not with money.
Yet the worst scandal, as you describe it, was associated with the Roman Emperor Nero.
Yeah, Nero turned up in 67 AD, and he was a great fan of Greek culture, so he came to the Olympics and he added poetry reading to the Olympic events. He carried off the laurels for that. And at the chariot race, he entered, it's normally a four-horse chariot, but he entered with a 10-horse chariot, which of course was incredibly unwieldy. So as he went round a corner, he fell out of the chariot, came in last, and the judges all awarded him victory anyway. They had been bribed massively beforehand, and also they probably thought it was sort of a wise idea to let him let him carry off the awards there.
Yet a year later, after his death in Rome, his name was stricken from the rolls, and I gather the bribees had to pay back the bribes.
Yes, they wanted to get rid of that whole sort of nasty episode, and so they cleaned up their record. And in fact, the Olympics were very highly regarded. There were other games where the athletes were buying and selling their victories like sacks of grain. But the Olympics was always remained fairly highly respected, and the scandals were the exception to the rule rather than, especially in the Roman era, corruption really permeated athletics.
Jeff, thank you.
Thank you.
Nero, not the only great name of history to pop up in this account of the Olympic Games. We hear of Alcibiades, the character who was such a protagonist in the Peloponnesian Wars. We hear of Plato attended incognito.
Yeah, Plato was a great wrestling fan. In fact, there's a record that he competed in the games in Corinth as a wrestler, and his name, Plautus. Plato comes from Plautus, which means broad-shouldered. It's sort of a nickname. His real name was Aristocles. So he actually came to the Olympic Games not telling anyone who he was. He bunked down in a tent with a bunch of strangers, saw the whole games, and then when he became quite close friends with these guys and invited them to visit him when they came to Athens. So they turned up and they were apparently astonished to discover that he was the most famous philosopher of Greece.
Let's get another caller in. Jerry's with us from Stowe, Ohio.
Hi, thank you very much for the program.
You're welcome.
Tony, I wondered if you could comment on the ancient event known as the All-Power Pancratian event and its resemblance to certain modern no-holds-barred martial arts tournaments.
Yeah, I think the Pancration, the closest we can come to it is the Thai kickboxing these days. It's sort of a mix of wrestling and kickboxing, and this somewhat ballet-like to start. It was extremely popular amongst the Greeks because the only thing that was banned was eye gouging. You could kick people in the genitals, one another in the genitals, and since you're naked, that could be quite agonizing. Finger breaking was allowed. There was one guy whose nickname was Mr. Digits. His speciality was getting people in holds and breaking their fingers one by one. Because, again, you could only win by making your opponent surrender and submit. He had to raise the finger if he had any non-broken fingers left.
I saw him against Bruno Sammartino once, Mr. Digits.
Right.
Yeah, anyway.
and foot twists, agonizing foot twists, and the judges apparently approved of strangling because that was the easiest way to get people to submit. But many preferred death to victory, and one of the most respected of Pancratius was a guy named Erichion. In 564 BC, he was being strangled on the ground, but just as he was dying, rather than submit, he grabbed his opponent's foot, twisting it so hard that the opponent gave up just as Erichion died. So his corpse was given full honours as a victor.
Jerry, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go with Guy, and Guy's with us from Mesa, Arizona.
How you doing? Thanks for the show.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to know, I think you just answered it, was it true that that they went nude in the Olympics? And I guess the follow-up to that would be why? And well, were women involved back then?
Okay, they're all good questions. And they, yes, absolutely all exercising and all competing in ancient Greece was in the nude. They lathered themselves up in olive oil, but entirely stark naked. Why is a question that the Greeks themselves actually forgot as by the classical era. Modern scholars assume that it dates back to initiation rites and things like that. But the Greeks, they had a couple of stories for why it might have happened. And one was that a runner was wearing a loincloth and he tripped and lost the race. And so from there on, everyone had to go naked. There was another story that a champion declared that he could go faster if he went naked, and then he ran and won the Olympic Games. And so the fashion became that everyone went naked. But more likely, it persisted anyway because of the vanity and exhibitionism of the ancient Greeks. They loved parading around like peacocks and preening and showing themselves off. So, and poets write these wonderful descriptions of their bodies with a tan, the colour of fired clay. So it was very much, it was inherent to the Greek athletic tradition. Other cultures looked at it quite askance. They thought it promoted sexual degeneracy. The Persians, for example, couldn't get it at all, and the Romans just thought it was entirely perverse. As the other question, whether there were women in the games, it was an all-male event. The Festival of Zeus was entirely male, and in fact, ancient Greece was an incredibly misogynistic society, and women weren't allowed into the gymnasium. They were given no education, basically. So the Olympics, not only were all the athletes all male, but married women weren't even allowed into the stadium as spectators. Virgins were allowed in, and in the peripheral areas there were many prostitutes working the crowd. But going into the actual games as spectators, married women weren't allowed. Now, having said that, there was a secondary games which were dedicated to the queen of the gods, Hera, where women, young women, teenagers, were allowed to compete. And all it was some foot races, and it was a very, very much a secondary event. But the girls ran in short tunics with one breast exposed, the right breast, which harked back to the Amazons, the mythical warrior women who had their right breast cauterized. It was cut off so it wouldn't interfere with their javelin throws. So this was the races that the women were allowed to participate in. And the big exception to that was Sparta. That was it was a very militaristic society, and that was the only place where women were allowed to go to the gymnasium. They were trained in physical to get to the peak of physical fitness because they wanted to be good mothers and thus raise good fine soldiers. So it wasn't exactly a proto-feminist paradise, but they were allowed to compete. They did get together in the ring. They'd oil each other down, wrestle naked, as naked as the men, and this became very popular amongst the Greek males, and there was a minor tourist industry developed around coming to watch the Spartan women oil themselves down and wrestle in sort of an incipient form of mud wrestling, I guess. And there are records actually of a Roman senator travelling to Sparta to observe it and becoming so excited he jumped into the ring to compete with one of the women.
Does it say how he did?
The records don't say. It's bizarre.
Must have lost.
Probably.
You'd think so.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Guy. Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Alexander Kitroev is Greek, a professor of history at Haverford College in Haverford, Pennsylvania, the author of Wrestling with the Ancients, Modern Greek Identity and the Olympics. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Good to be here.
You write that while Greeks take great pride and a sense of ownership, as well they should, over the Olympics, there's a struggle between to balance the glories of the past and the realities of today. What's this tension?
Well, the tension has to do with the modern Olympics wanting to model themselves on the concepts of sport of the ancient past, and the fact that sport was seen as a vehicle that enabled human excellence. So the Olympics hark back to the past, but on the other hand, as we've seen in the 20th century, the Olympics are big business as well. They've got to deal with political boycotts, performance-enhancing drugs, commercialization, a number of things. So you've got two different tensions there. And the Greeks, of course, the modern Greece, see themselves as the bridge that connects the Olympics from the present to their past. But on the other hand, the Greeks have to be wary. If they are going to play a role in the modern Olympics, they've got to address the modern concerns as well.
Mm-hmm. Is there concern in Greece with, we've heard of some of what Tony Parate was describing as these sort of faux pagan elements of the modern games, the torch and that sort of thing, the costumes that some of the people wear. Do Greeks have a problem with that?
Oddly enough, they don't. The Greeks have a sense of identity which goes back to the ancient past and then goes through the centuries and takes in Christianity and the modern era as well, and they're perfectly happy. The lighting ceremony that took place on March 25th featured somebody dressed as a priestess who asked the god Apollo to help light the flame at the ceremony in ancient Olympia. This was seen as part of the Greece's heritage. No problem with that, even though Greece is 95% Christian Orthodox.
Mm-hmm. In fact, Tony Parate, the Christian era is responsible for the end of the ancient games, isn't it?
Yes, so it was Theodosius I who banned all pagan festivals in the Roman Empire. He was the emperor, and of course the Olympics was the grandest and most prestigious of those. So in 393 AD was the last Olympic Games that we know about. About 40 years later, Theodosius II ordered the sacking of the Temple of Zeus and the destruction of the sanctuary. The great statue of Zeus, 40-foot-tall statue that
one
was
one of the wonders of the ancient world.
Yeah, it was actually taken to, as far as we understand, it was taken to Constantinople, but it perished in a palace fire some centuries later. So unfortunately, that was lost as well. And so the whole site of Olympia became overrun, and earthquakes, flooding from the rivers. It was virtually lost until 1766, when a English antiquarian was roaming around Greece, and he found some fragments of some columns, and actually using a 2nd century AD travel guide written by Pausanias, discerned that that was the Temple of Zeus, and excavations began in the 19th century.
And we're Professor Kitroev, the Greeks have from time to time, the modern Greeks have said, look, the ancient games ran for 1,200 years in Olympia. Why don't we make one site for the Olympic Games, make it in Greece, have it here every 4 years?
Yes. The first time they said that was after the first modern Olympic Games of 1896. The Greek king got so enthusiastic with the successful organization, he proposed that. And many people thought it was a good idea. The American delegation, made up of basically American college students, unanimously approved. They thought it was a great idea. But the reviver of the modern Olympics, the Baron de Coubertin, was interested in ancient traditions, but also internationalism. So he was very concerned that if the Olympics stayed in Greece, one would lose the international dimension. The Greeks got back to that in the 1970s and 1980s, when the Olympics ran into the troubles having to do with the boycotts of the Cold War. They proposed that that again, and it was taken seriously for several years.
We're speaking about Olympic Games, modern and ancient. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Aaron, who joins us from North Oaks, Minnesota. Hello, Aaron, are you there? Aaron has apparently left us. Let's try with Mike, who's with us from Cottage Grove, Minnesota.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I used to watch Hercules on TV, and there was an episode where they said Hercules started the Olympics. And I was wondering, is this an actual myth from ancient Greece or that Hercules started the Olympics, or is this just a myth that came from the TV series?
Just a Kevin Sorbo myth. Go ahead, Tony.
There's lots of different traditions and legends about how the Olympic Games started, and that was one of them. So it wasn't made up by Steve Reeves or somebody, the legend went that he declared games there and that he actually stepped out the stadium himself because the stadium it was done by the length of the feet, which is why stadiums all over ancient Greece were different lengths, the running tracks. So yeah, it was one of the many legends about the start of the Olympic Games, but there were so many that Strabo, the geographer in the first century AD, when he was writing a book about the geography of the Mediterranean, writing about Olympia, he said there were so many and they were so confusing that no one can really know. So the Greeks themselves realized that it was way too confusing.
Mike, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
But given that and given all of the confusion over the origins of the games, how did you do your research? I mean, there were no sports pages to go back and figure out who had won when and in what time.
Well, there's actually quite a lot written about it at the time because the surviving literary sources, almost everyone who was anyone went to the games at some stage or wrote about it. So what you can do is go through you know histories, you go through plays, artwork, theatrical works, and everyone refers to it at one stage or another. So you take these little details, and they're often talking about something completely different, but you take these details and you put them together to create a picture of it day by day, step by step. As well, there's also the vase paintings, extremely graphic depictions of what went on at the games. Everything from the the victory banquets and the orgies to the sports themselves, eye gougings. Athletes being thrashed by judges for infractions. So you can start to put together all these details, and then you combine that with the actual site itself. If you do approach it like day by day, step by step, and sort of think, little things like where do they get their food, where do they go to the bathroom, things like that, then it starts to come together as a more coherent image of the festival.
Mm-hmm. Professor Kitroev, how are Greeks looking forward to the... I know there's some controversies about getting things ready, but they're looking forward to the games?
They're looking forward to the games with a great deal of trepidation on the one hand, but also a sense of responsibility. The Olympics are part of modern Greece's identity. They feel very proprietary of this concept of the Olympics, both the ancient and the modern. The preparation started very slowly. They've speeded up over the past few months. I think the people of Athens are going to be looking forward to when all the digging and banging stops. The rest of the country is keeping its breath, but I think everyone's worried, but very optimistic that it'll all work out well.
Alexander Kitroev, thank you very much for being with us today. Thank you. Professor of History at Haverford College in Haverford, Pennsylvania. He's the author of Wrestling with the Ancients, Modern Greek Identity and the Olympics. When we come back from a short break, we'll take a couple more of your questions about the ancient Olympic Games. We'll also talk about the current controversy involving American athletes and doping, and a poem attributed to Abraham Lincoln, Soliloquy on Suicide. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Tony Perrottet, the author of The Naked Olympics, The True Story of the Ancient Games. And I wanted to ask you, this was one of the many ancient sports festivals and that were held, as we mentioned earlier, in many parts of the Aegean, the Greek area of that part of the world, and one of the few that did not involve a formal competition involving literary accomplishment. Yet you point out some important literary works made their debut at the Olympic Games.
Yes, Herodotus was the, apart from being the father of history, he can be regarded as the father of PR. He actually had written his history of the Persian Wars, and he was thinking, I can go around from city to city around the Mediterranean, or I can go to Olympia, where all the most important and famous Greeks are in one spot. So he went there, and on the first afternoon of the games, he went into the Temple of Zeus, which was very crowded at the time, and started reading his work. The audience was apparently transfixed, and word of his achievement spread like wildfire around the around the site, and everyone left Olympia, went back to their towns and spoke about Herodotus, and soon, according to the author Lucian, he was more famous than the Olympian victors themselves, which was in ancient times saying something. So a great tradition began of premiering your top literary works there, and the story goes that Thucydides as well came to Olympia to read his History of the Peloponnesian Wars, and other authors over the centuries followed suit.
Let's get another caller on the line. Daniel is with us from Hayesville, Kansas.
Hi there.
Hi.
I seem to recall that there was like a 100-meter dash in full armor. And in the time of lighter uniforms, lighter shoes, top technology, I'd love to see a race where all the athletes have to make the run wearing 60, 70 pounds of metal.
Yeah, that would be something. That would be something. It was a single lap of the stadium, which was actually 200 meters long. And it was the event that closed the games, basically the last athletic event. And it evoked the military origins of athletic training. It was regarded as a somewhat comic coda to the whole event because after seeing these naked guys, you know, running in very elegant up and down the stadium, the guys in armor were clunking along, and they were often tripping, dropping their helmets and their shields. So it was regarded as, frankly, rather silly as time went on.
Yeah, but don't you think that just to see as an entrance test?
Sorry, what was that?
To see it as a test? Did you say, Daniel? I think Daniel's phone
Daniel's
has
okay.
betrayed him. Anyway, let's get one more caller in. Diego has been very patient on the line from San Francisco.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Diego.
Yeah, I was just interested in hearing about the origins of the marathon, and I guess more specifically if that can be derived from an event in the Peloponnesian or the Persian Wars.
Persian Wars, I suspect.
Yeah, there were actually two traditions of in the Persian Wars. It was that the main story was that at the Battle of Marathon, when the Athenians stopped the Persians in this famous battle, a runner ran all the way back to Athens, burst into the main square, announced, "We won," and then dropped dead. And that distance from Marathon to Athens has become the format of the games. There was no actual marathon race in the Olympics at all. The longest race was 24 laps of the stadium, which was 4,800 yards, about 3 miles. So this tradition, there was another tradition that a runner actually went from Athens to Sparta to ask for help when the Persians attacked. But the marathon one is the one that persists.
It was Pheidippides, the name of the runner from Marathon to Athens, at least according to history. And of course, the Greek word that he uttered as he ran into the square to tell the Athenians that they had won the Battle of Marathon and better get down to the beach to beat off the Persian Navy was Nike.
Thank you.
Diego, thanks very much for the call.
All right, bye.
And Tony Perrottet, we appreciate your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tony Perrottet's new book is The Naked Olympics, The True Story of the Ancient Games. He joined us from our bureau in New York.